www.thebrainfarm.com.
This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast. And I'm here, as usual, with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not bad. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, pretty good. Enjoying the fact that we are in the next stage of release of lockdown. And of course, people can now go to the pub. And what does it do? It snows.
Yeah, it did. It was very odd. Sometimes it snows in April, and it did. Well, I think we're in technically what some people are calling lockdown light.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I'm not in any rush to go to the hairdressers or the shops or the pub, to be honest. But I can see why people are doing it. It's just fascinating that the day that it happens is the day we have horrendous weather, but then that's probably a pretty British thing, I would say.
Well, is that? And also, I think our Prime Minister was looking for a photo op, and then he realised he couldn't do that, so he's not going to the pub until after Prince Philip's funeral, which is in, well, depending when you release this, it'll probably be tomorrow, but it's certainly when we're recording in about a week's time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we're recording on the day that NVIDIA made a lot of announcements, which we might touch on and not touch on as we get through to that level of conversation. But today we're going to talk about the idea of software and storage and whether, based on the news we heard from Vast8 last week, whether all storage companies are now really moving to being software-only storage companies. Probably more interesting in terms of the discussion is, if you're a customer, how do you now position yourself with that sort of announcement and get into the detail? So do you want to start us off by explaining exactly what you think Vast has done, if you really do understand it?
Well, do I really understand it? I'm not sure. So this is my take on it. Vast have announced something called Gemini. So that is obviously coming from Twins. And they're saying, okay, so there is any software and in any storage appliance, you have hardware and software. What they have done is they have disconnected those. So you no longer buy hardware from them, which sounds pretty normal. We've seen a storage of software before, but it's not quite as simple as that. You buy your hardware from a hardware partner, their integrator, which I believe is Avnet.
Yep.
So you buy that, and then you buy the software from Vast, but that seems to be going to a capacity-based subscription model. And that's kind of where it is. So they've very loosely coupled this. You buy the hardware support. Actually, the hardware support model seems to be a bit strange. I think you're paying Avnet for the hardware support, but No, that's not the case, is it? No. This is where it gets weird. The software subscription includes the hardware support for the hardware you've bought from Avnet. However, that feels a bit strange because Vast don't actually have a hardware support network, so I don't know who their partner is to provide that hardware support. I have a sneaking suspicion it's probably Avnet.
So I think that is the case. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
But that's all a bit odd. But basically, you buy your software from one place, you buy your hardware from another place. If we were to think about it in things like vSAN and things like that, vSAN, you can buy your software from VMware, you buy your hardware from whoever, as long as it's on the HCL, really. In this case, I'd say you have an HCL of one, and that the HCL is the Avnet.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. I just wanted to touch on Gemini for a second. I was desperate to try and find a way to get in to a blog post I wrote, the idea of the Gemini Man. You know, there was the film The Gemini Man with Will Smith. That was a terrible film, absolutely awful film. But there was a 1970s TV series called The Gemini Man, which they only made one series of, which was also terrible. I don't remember whether you remember seeing that.
I know the title. I don't remember the premise.
So it was a classic sort of Spider-Man thing, you know, radiation guy gets superpowers type stuff. Yeah. I think he was underwater and he was a diver, and basically the radiation made him invisible. So they built this watch which he could basically control the invisibility, made him visible, but he could only go invisible for 15 minutes a day, otherwise he'd die. But when he did go invisible, everything would go invisible. So all the clothes he was wearing, the watch, everything would suddenly become invisible. And then he could use that to go and help him be a secret agent. But it was a terrible series. So it seems like don't create anything as a TV show with Gemini in the title.
It sounds like it. There was a terrible, terrible pop band. I think there was our entry in a Eurovision way back when, which was Gemini.
Gosh, yeah, they were rubbish too.
Yeah, so there you go. So Vast, not a well-starred name. That's all we will say.
Yes. Right. Okay. So let's move on from that. So basically, yes, you're right. It's effectively a disaggregation of the hardware and software, but still using Vast's original hardware partner who they would have actually delivered through and with. So all they're doing is a bit of, I think, financial trickery here to push the money in different directions. I don't think we need to go into that today, but I think we'll, you know, if we come back to it, we can. But I just wanted to go on and talk about where else we've seen this. So we know that, for example, Caminario decided they couldn't go any further with the hardware business, so they dropped it and went pure software with a bit of a rebrand or a new company, perhaps, I don't know. And they called themselves Silk. So they're all basically cloud, I think. I don't even think they're doing on-premises version. We know that Nasuni, we talked to many, many years ago, multiple times, they basically did sell a hardware appliance, but it was optional. You could just run it as a VM. So they'd already abstracted. Nutanix did it recently and went with a software model, and they had the thing called Clusters, which you can run in the public cloud. Pure had Cloud Block Store. NetApp had Azure Files in the cloud. Dell has allowed you to do OneFS Isilon in the cloud. Don't know whether you can build your own system for that. But obviously, there's a bit of a theme here coming in terms of a lot of these companies being very public cloud focused in their migration strategy.
That is, and you're saying that's quite cloud focused. There are models, I can't go into too much detail about it, from Dell, where, and I suspect other vendors as well, where you can disaggregate even for your on-premises storage. You can buy the hardware and then you can take the software as a subscription, and you can be, this allows you some amount of flexibility about how you refresh, where you might use that software. You might say, very much like an ELA, if you think about an enterprise license agreement for any piece of software, but you might just buy a bucket of it and say, actually, here's my $1 million a year bucket, and I decide how I'm going to deploy it. But it allows you potentially to, when you're refreshing the hardware, you only actually ever pay to refresh the hardware, and that has some financial advantages for companies who want to change their OPEX CAPEX model.
Yeah. One other I just suddenly thought of was Element OS and SolidFire. So originally that was tightly bundled, but I think if you were big enough, you could go and talk to them and that you could sort of unbundle the two, separate the two. So it's not without precedent, this particular model. It's just that's where Vast has moved to. So why do it then? I mean, you sort of touched on that first reason there, Martin. Potentially a large customer might have a better buying power at the hardware layer. So that might actually be quite a suitable way of doing things.
Yeah, could be. And certainly if you had a relationship with a hardware vendor and it was kind of accepted, you might find that you could buy it cheaper from the OEM yourselves as a large customer, or even directly from, say, Dell or HP, and then you layer the software on top.
Mm. Now, I wonder about that, though, and we'll use the Vast one as an example. The Vast hardware is quite specific in the sense that it's basically just a disk shelf with a couple of other components in, because it uses base NVMe over Fabrics as a way of allowing the front-end controllers, which are stateless, to talk to the back-end disk. And I recommend everybody goes and looks at the previous podcasts that we did last year or the year before when we recorded with them, because that really gives some good detail there. And I'll link to those in the show notes. But obviously, that's very specific hardware, so it's not like you can repurpose that as a general server. Whereas if you've got a deal with somebody like HPE or Dell, you might be buying hundreds or thousands of servers, and then you might be able to just say, well, you know, that 10% of servers will now be the storage clusters, so we can direct them there. So I can sort of see this as a slightly different model in that sense. But in general, I guess if we're moving more to SDS, that idea of saying, well, we're just buying physical servers, just make some of them the storage component. Sort of makes sense, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, it does. And some very large enterprises will have relationships with the disk vendors in their own right. So this is how it could work for Vast, for instance, where you could say, actually, you know what, I'm going to go and buy all the NVMe disks off
that
your
is true. Yeah.
List of NVMe disks, and then you just get your systems integrator or your integration partner in Avnet to stick those in the chassis for me. Because I can buy at a better rate than, say, Avnet or Vast or however.
And if you're petabyte scale, you know, a good chance you're doing that anyway, you know, why not? Yeah. I think the other thing with this, and I think this is quite an interesting one, is if you are going to go software only, you still need somehow to support your global operation if you are global. So the Vast solution, for example, isn't targeted at somebody who's got 50 terabytes worth of data. This is targeted at somebody who's got hundreds of terabytes, typically multi-petabytes, and therefore they might well be global at that point. And therefore, if you're building a support network, you still need to have a way of being able to get to those customers wherever they're located. And Vast is still partnering with somebody like Avnet because that gives them that global reach that they wouldn't have otherwise.
It's incredibly expensive to set up your own hardware support network. And it's so what happens is most of the hardware startups like Vast would do, they would be outsourcing that hardware support to somebody who does it, whether it's Avnet. There are plenty of other companies which will do it. Even large companies have done it in the past. I mean, Dell EMC, for instance, I don't know if they still do, but certainly in the past used Unisys to do hardware support for some of their... Right. So it's not an uncommon model for anybody to do it like this.
Yeah.
But as I say, it's expensive. You don't necessarily want to have to do it and if you establish this model pretty early on, that means you probably never have any risk of having to do it.
Yeah. Okay. And here's the third reason why, and we've just talked about it already to a certain degree. Here's the third reason why it might be worth going down the route of being software only. And we're still talking about this from a vendor perspective, and that's the positioning for the cloud. A lot of the vendors we talked about already like the idea of being able to push their software into the public cloud, running as a thin layer above the hardware, which is effectively what Silk is doing. And that gives them that ability to charge for a license and push the cost of the physical infrastructure or the virtual infrastructure off to the client. So all they're doing is charging for a software license, and then that can become perhaps a subscription. So this is ongoing money they're making rather than being a perpetual license and a piece of hardware that they're selling every 3 years.
Yeah, so they can build up a recurring revenue model and an ad hoc revenue model. I mean, if you think about it, so you could go to some like AWS Marketplace and say, I need to buy 100 terabytes or 200 terabytes or 500 terabytes worth of license for a month, or I just need to run it for a month. That's what I need to do. This allows them to do that.
So yeah, that's a really good point. So if you look at, say, the container market and storage for containers, we've seen that Portworx do a per hour, per day, or whatever their license model is. It's a time-based model.
Yeah.
And I know that Robin.io have just announced through Red Hat an equivalent sort of model where you can pay for your storage capacity per node per hour, which is then billed back through Red Hat's marketplace and goes onto your Red Hat bill. Now, that is a really interesting model because that's very, very cloud-like, even though it's in your own data center. And that seems to be a really interesting way that we're moving towards, where rather than you buying a perpetual license that might be monthly, we could even get down to that granularity of hourly, which was probably unfathomable 4 or 5 years ago, but now seems like it's a really good use case for scenarios where, for instance, you want to build up a cluster, run some analysis work or whatever, and then shut it down and move on.
But you're saying that's on-premises?
That particular one is, yes. And I think
that's a really interesting one, because it's an old saying, why would I pay you to tell the time on my own watch? And you almost feel like you're getting into that state. Because you spin it up, you spin it back down again. Well, then what do you do? I mean, you assume that we're going to be reconfiguring your data center storage on a fairly regular basis. 1 minute I need that kind of file system or that performance profile. The next minute I'm going to need that. But from my point of view, that particular use case doesn't feel compelling.
Okay. I can see where it could be useful if the features that it offers give you the sort of things you need to do in the way that you're spinning that data up and that system up and shutting it down. So it's going to come down to, are those features valid for you to put that extra layer in? Similarly, I guess for people like Silk, if you're going to do it in the cloud, is it logical to put that extra layer in? And from their perspective, they're trying to sell it on a performance opportunity, distributing the data and getting better performance. And I would imagine they're also including things like dedupe, which saves you cost because there's no dedupe in the cloud for block store or even object store. So I think, yeah, I agree. You're right. You know, there's got to be a good use case. And for you, that wouldn't be one. But I guess for other people, there is.
It might be. I can see it's a very good set use case in the public cloud. It doesn't feel when I've sunk cost on infrastructure on premises, I don't see you reconfiguring your underlying infrastructure that often at the moment. Maybe it will become better practice or a best practice or different practice. But it's an interesting idea.
I think there's a trade-off there, and this wasn't really the way that we were going to head off in this discussion.
No, but I think it's worth pull that back.
Yeah, but it's worth very quickly having it. But there is a trade-off there that says, am I going to go down the route that I deploy a layer of software which allows me to do something like the container model and distribute the data across multiple servers in a resilient fashion? Or am I going to go down the route of just saying, do you know what, I can use NVMe over Fabrics, over some network, probably IP, so NVMe TCP, and just point a volume from a shared enclosure to my server. And then if I need to move that, I just move that mapping. There's going to be a few different ways to do this. And effectively, it's all software.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go back and talk about what VAST is doing this for. Is it really just financial engineering, do you think? Is that a bit harsh on them?
Is it financial engineering? There is a big chunk of financial engineering for this. They want to make their investors happy something. But also, I can see that they're thinking about, okay, how do I convince new customers, actually, that I'm doing something different? Now, yeah, they can talk about performance. They can talk about how wonderful it is. And they can, but we've discussed this before. Performance isn't really a feature. Nobody really cares too much. And when we start getting NVMe over Fabric and things like that, you've got performance coming out of the wazoo. So what do you do? And this almost allows them to come in with a different conversation. I think it's a door opener as well. So, oh, we've got this different idea. And I think that's quite important for a startup to get to have those conversations. And they probably want to expand their market.
I'd add one other thing, that if you go back and remember what we discussed with them when we had the two podcasts with Howard, I'm fairly certain in all the things I've read as well and on all the things I've seen, that they major much more on throughput and IOPS than they do on latency. This is a sale or sell of their technology for managing vast amount of throughput and capacity. So it's not all about getting that super micro latency out of everything. It's just not the way it's designed, which makes it pretty suitable for the public cloud, where you're really more interested in the bandwidth than you are about the latency, at least the way that it's presented to you from the public cloud provider. The VMs that you get given tend to talk more about throughput and IOPS and very little about latency to those individual volumes.
But at the moment, we're not talking about public cloud.
No, they're not. I'm making a massive, massive leap and thinking, well, where is this business going to go next? You know, what else do you do? If you convert to a subscription license, then that's an obvious opportunity to sell yourself into the public cloud, where you don't have to ship any infrastructure. You just simply say, off you go. There's a question there about whether that's practical, about whether running multiple VMs just to get access to data, to physical block storage, is really practical. And I'm not really sure about that yet. I'll come on and explain that in a minute. But I'm just trying to work out where I think they might go next.
I think you're right. I can see them going for some kind of public cloud offering. I think they're going to try and dabble, like a lot of people are doing. How do I do hybrid? I think that's quite important for a lot of large enterprises and a lot of large customers. How do I get a common storage layer across my whole estate? That is certainly of interest. Public cloud does bring them challenges, but yeah, I could see them going down a public cloud route. I think they're going to be starting to think about, okay, how do we grow our capability? Because at the moment, it's just an NFS Samba box, which can do S3 as well, as far as I know, at the front.
Yes, effectively, without trivialising the enormous amount of work that the company's obviously done to build out a piece of infrastructure. The architecture is effectively back-end disk with a mixture of Optane and Flash, and then front, and on which, by the way, is stored data and metadata, pretty much mixed between the two, but with the Optane as the target for all of that because of the write capabilities. And then you have stateless front-end controllers, which effectively have got the NFS protocol, which split that IO request up and distribute it across all the disks. Yeah. Now, my only issue, I think, seeing where they, if they do decide to go to the cloud, is that they're very much focused on JBoffs, just a bunch of Flash in shells.
Yeah.
So there's no like back-end server as such. All the logic and everything is done by the front-end controller, which is stateless. So the front-end controller could just be a VM, dead easy. If that dies and comes back up again, you don't care. You just instance it again. Every end user could even have their own VM or even their own container environment running that VM on each instance. The question is, how do you do that back-end stuff? Because I don't think there's any cloud instance you get where it's just basically disk with a very small VM or even direct access to the disk. But maybe the cloud providers might come out and offer and like an NVMe disk across the network that you can access directly. And if they do, that might be a way of dealing with that. But their architecture may not directly fit that market today, perhaps.
I don't think it's there yet. I could see the big three cloud vendors, their two targets for the time being will be Azure and GCP, AWS every indication I had from talking to vendors is AWS just makes your life harder to deal with. So doing it with Azure and GCP would make a lot of sense. And I think they might find they get a bit more flexibility about what they can and what they can't do. I think if you start looking at those vendors who are offering things like filers in the cloud, you can see that it's Azure and GCP are the people they tend to be doing this. And there's got to be reasons for that.
Amazon have decided they want to plow their own furrow, haven't they?
Yeah.
Yep. And they're going to do it themselves. Yeah, that's fine. You know, they're the biggest cloud provider, and they can at this point still continue to do that. So, you know, that's fine. It's up to them. Okay. I'm going to move us on and ask a quite relevant question. And that is, should we be worried that if everything is going to be software, that we might see some hardware innovations starting to stall? And the reason I ask that question is because VAST built an architecture that's very much a modified hardware architecture, as in they've cut swathes of the hardware out in order to make it very simple, but they rely on the features of NVMe and the features of Optane in order to deliver that architecture. We talked to Store One multiple times with George, and they also have an architecture that's very much dependent on the benefits of Optane and how that is written to and how you write that data down onto the underlying disks. So are we at risk of seeing a lack of innovation in hardware coming along that might cause us to not see as many innovations in storage as we would like to see?
That's a very interesting question, because if we look at the server market, we've not seen any innovation in the server market for, 20 years, probably? The innovations are incremental improvements. You get more CPUs, we get faster PCIe buses. We're not seeing anything else. But we're starting to see innovation come around again. We've talked about the people. We've talked about the fungibles and things who are actually going to see this innovation. So I think we might see some stagnation of innovation in the storage market. I'd say we've not seen a massive amount of innovation as such within the past 10 years anyway. But it is a risk until somebody comes along with a really great idea. Mm. That's where we always have been.
So today we had the NVIDIA GTC conference kickoff. And I don't know whether you caught it, but I watched the keynote, and actually I had a briefing last week as well anyway. The two things that stuck out there that made me think that we're likely to see some hardware changes are BlueField 3, which is like BlueField 2 on steroids, if you understand that expression. 16 ARM cores, PCIe 5. So there's a massive focus from that company on trying to get the SmartNIC market even faster and more evolved. And also they came out with this idea of something called Grace, which on a single board, and I'm not exactly sure entirely of the form factor yet, you've got GPU and ARM, which seems to be like a real punch in the face for Intel in the x86 market. So we are seeing hardware innovations. The question is how those then translate into something we can use in the storage world. And the question is whether we even want to, because as Chris Mellor posted today, he posted an article which quoted some Gartner numbers, and the external controller-based storage market is just set to flatline for the next 5 years. So it doesn't seem to me that that side of the market is really as relevant as it was. And it seems to me that more likely we are seeing innovation in that component level for things like delivering, as you said, Fungible and other vendors like that.
I've looked at that piece from Chris, and obviously Gartner have done some analysis, and I have no reason to disagree with it. I think the external storage market, I think we're seeing some, I think it probably is plateauing, or the growth is going to be very, very low. I wonder if some of this is due to how hybrid is coming into play within the storage market more and more. With you have your active data sets, which you'll be keeping on high-speed NVMe over fabric devices or just high-speed devices, and you're tearing off. And I think we're seeing quite a lot of data getting teared off into the cloud. I think that's what we're beginning to see. So, yeah, I'm expecting it to flatline because the working sets are growing, but they're not growing massively. And actually, as you start looking at the working set of data you require to have on your performance disk, but you may have better ways of dealing with the age data and actually pulling it out. So we may find that we're going to start right-sizing that performance tier, which is where the external storage often is playing. We throw into the mix people like vSAN, things like vSAN, those people who virtualize more. Yeah, I can see that will flatline. I can't see there being a massive amount of growth in that space.
Remember, that's also cost. It's not actual capacity. So as prices drop, and as we see more cheaper, we shouldn't really say cheaper, should we say perhaps more affordable flash, it may well be that it's not changing. It's the revenue that's flatlining, but not necessarily the capacity. So as you said, you are seeing those high performance centralized, possibly block solutions, growing in capacity, but not necessarily growing in revenue.
Yeah, I think you're right. But for a long time, we saw revenues increasing because the amount of storage you were buying far outstripped the price of the annual price of client storage. I think we may be seeing that changing somewhat. I think it'd be very interesting if you could start breaking out what the hyperscalers are spending on disks and whether a lot of this storage is really ending up in their space. And I suspect it's quite a lot, which is beginning to end in their first space. And a lot of large data sets, aged data sets, are ending up in things like Glacier and Deep Glacier and the Google equivalents.
Yeah. So let's get to the crux of the matter then, because at the end of the day, we're not vendors, but we are potentially customers, and we're at that other end of the market. One of the things that strikes me with this is that it starts to make things a little bit more, not necessarily confusing for the customer, but it expands their thinking about the choices that they have to make. So we talked to Hitachi last year, and they were doing storage as a service. We've talked to Infinidat, and they had all their variable pricing opportunities, their elastic pricing, whatever they called it, the different features to be able to buy. Now we've got Vast with the option to split the hardware and software costs. And it seems to me that potentially now you are creating a lot more complex model that you have to build in order to understand what the best route to go is.
Yeah, I think so. But that seems to be the world of IT at the moment, Chris. We've got FinOps for cloud, financial operations for cloud. That's become a big thing. It's always been the way in IT that your average IT, enterprise IT manager has to have some kind of finance background and expertise as well, understanding leasing contracts, support contracts, difference between OPEX and CAPEX. I think that's just been the role of the IT manager. But yeah, I think it probably does add another level of complexity. Oh, well, it keeps our friends in finance and procurement happy. They get more contracts and more models to start playing with. It's not technical innovation.
No, absolutely not. I think that's the bit for me is a bit of a challenge, because I suppose I can sort of see if you look at the things where pricing for software anyway is going down to a per hour or per day or per month, you know, you can mitigate the risk of that by saying, well, we did it for a month and then we didn't like it and we're going to move away. We all know that many years ago, if you decided to go and buy a particular array from a vendor and it didn't work out, you were screwed for 3 years until, you know, that rolled out and it would sit in a corner, or you wouldn't use it, or you perhaps wouldn't put the priority stuff on it. Here, I think, you know, you're in a similar situation where you could be committing to an ongoing license where you then get a pile of hardware you can't do anything with. And I'm not saying this is just Vast, by the way. This is not saying that it's stuff that you would take from them that you wouldn't be able to use. But all of these vendors that are pushing towards trying to split the hardware so you take the ownership of it whilst they just give you a software license, you could look at it and say that it's starting to put a lot more of the risk back onto the customer, and the customer now has to be a bit more savvy.
I think customers going to have to be a lot more savvy. The customer can no longer do what customers have done in the past, where you find yourself, you've got an old aging piece of kit. You know, you may decide you're just going to drop it off maintenance, hardware and software maintenance. As long as you have a perpetual license, you're good to go. You can't do any upgrades or anything, but it doesn't stop you using it. With some of these models which we're seeing with subscription-based modeling, you suddenly find that you don't have that option. You're going to have to keep paying that subscription, whatever happens. Potentially, even if that software is no longer supported, because actually your subscription is the right to use. And that's,
it gets complicated.
And that's actually what happens in the Red Hat world.
Okay.
So that's a model we've been seeing more and more today. So if you were to have a large out-of-date Red Hat estate, say a load of Red Hat 5, for instance, you may find you're still playing subscription on a model, despite the fact you can't upgrade it. So actually what you really want to do is then go and convert it all to CentOS or something like that, which is a relatively easy thing to do. But that's the model they're going for. And it's really interesting. You could have Vast could find themselves, or anybody could find themselves, with recurring revenue on software they're not actually maintaining and doing anything of, but it's just the right to use.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? That changes that idea of what a license really means at that point.
Yeah.
Because you're expecting license to mean, well, it's maintenance, and therefore, because I'm paying maintenance on this, surely there's got to be some value to it other than just right to use. You know, you should be producing fixes for me. And if it's not the current version, maybe new features don't come in the current version, but at best, patching, fixes, protection for any bugs that come out, that all should be included if you're paying a maintenance cost. So that's a really interesting scenario. So do you think, as a result, we need more clarity around these models to help people really understand exactly which one is going to be more suitable for them?
Yeah, I think we probably do. We need more clarity in it. I think there needs to be a lot more understanding about what this software model looks like. I don't think it's particularly hard to understand, but I think it is quite difficult for some of the infrastructure people to understand. It's a very similar model as to the way you'd pay for your Adobe or Office 365. If you stop paying your licenses, you can't use it anymore. It's quite easy.
True. I guess the difference is Adobe doesn't tell you what PC or Mac that you have to buy in order to use this.
No, software. This is true. That's where it gets a bit more interesting. I understand that. Yeah.
Well, so what? Yeah, go on.
Apple do. Yeah, you get a choice.
Yeah, you get a choice of basically Apple's OS or nothing.
Yeah.
If you're going to use any of their products. Okay, so from your perspective, Martin, what would you be doing on a daily basis with if you were a customer, without giving away any idea of what you do when you're in your day job? But what would you recommend people start thinking about, and how would you approach it?
I'd go on an Excel course.
Ah, good start.
And then so you're going to find yourself modeling this, and the problem you're going to find is you're going to find yourself in apples and oranges a lot of the time, because you are going to be comparing traditional infrastructure purchase models with subscription models, differences between OPEX and CAPEX. But I think you just, at the end of the day, you're going to have to sit there and model what your cash looks like to some extent, and look at how much it's going to cost you over 5-10 years. That's all you can do. And accept the fact that you might have to really take Refresh a lot more seriously. In fact, this actually it may even strengthen your hand when you're going to ask for a Refresh budget. So actually, for an IT manager, it might actually be quite a good thing. People can't just say, well, we'll just leave it on. We'll just leave it ticking on. We won't pay anything. We'll just tick it on. So it may actually be, these kind of models may actually be useful for you.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. So, I mean, one of the things that I thought with some of these, the ongoing discussion that we're having here, you know, in this scenario, is that as we move towards software defined, we move further away from the appliance model. In the appliance model, and, you know, you get somebody like EMC comes out and sells you a box, and then 3 years later they come along. I say EMC, it's not EMC, Dell EMC. Yeah. They come along 3 years later and they say, ah, look, we'll sell you this box for £1 million, or we'll sell you a 2 year maintenance cost for £500,000. And you're like, oh, that sounds like a better deal just to Refresh. So you end up going for a Refresh. They take the hardware back as part of the deal. They then strip that down and sell it on to other customers and use it for support, because they've got an inventory of parts they need to keep hold of. To a certain degree, you get some value, some residual value for this technology. And if you would, say, use the analogy of buying a car, or leasing a car, renting a car, you know, you could buy a car, spend the capital up front, or even lease purchase it. At the end of 3 years, the car's yours. You could then trade that car in the next time you want to buy, or you could just hold on to it and service it every year, keep it for another 5 years. You don't get charged by the manufacturer of the car to drive it around after 3 years. The alternative is, of course, you could go for a lease, and you, after 3 years, have to give that car back either way. And at that point, you're stuffed because you have no car. So you have to keep on paying. So we're sort of moving towards the lease model rather than the purchase model. And that does change your outcome, I think, and certainly your outlook on things. Because if you were to suddenly say to one of these vendors, I'm not going to take something from you tomorrow, they switch off the software license, everything stops working, and you're going to go out and buy from scratch. So, you know, it does make your thinking a bit different.
Yeah, it does. So you're going to have to think a lot more about what this really does look like for you. As I say, you're going to have to, I think you have to model cycles. You're going to have to, you need to model your Refresh cycles and look at exactly how this hangs together. There's some interesting things. We've always assumed the price per terabyte of storage goes down.
Yes.
Because it does. Now, and a lot of that's been driven by the cost of the actual underlying components, the hardware components.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've disaggregated this, the price of the hardware will go down. You know that. What happens to the price of that software? Is the price of that software per terabyte going to go down, or is that going to maintain as a fixed price per terabyte? What license models are we going to see? I am assuming, as a customer, that both are going to decline, because if they don't, my actual assumptions about what my budget and my price model looks like going forward could be horribly wrong.
It could be, and you could find that, you know, let's say, I think I've said in the past, we used to assume many years ago 5% per quarter decline in the hardware costs. Because, you know, capacities of drives would increase and so on. So you can sort of see that's still possible. But has the cost of a Microsoft license declined year on year? Or has it increased year on year? I'd say it's almost certainly increased year on year. So the traditional model for software licensing not storage software licensing, just software licensing in general, is to have at least an incremental increase, if not when a new product comes out, to have a big increase every time, you know, you get the next OS or you get the next version of a particular product. So there's precedent to say that the cost of the software storage license cost could increase, even if it's just incremental, or even if it's just flatlined, effectively it would still be an increase in relative terms to the hardware. So splitting these two out could actually change that dynamic significantly.
It could do. It'd be interesting to watch.
It's one area to definitely watch, because I think that's something that people might not necessarily be aware of and might get caught out if they don't realise that they're not going to see what they thought they were going to see from the vendors and, you know, traditionally.
I would say for any customer out there or anybody who's interested, and even if you're not procuring or involved in procurement process, see if you can get a copy of the actual bill of materials for your storage. And look how much you're paying for hardware and how much the software line items are. Hopefully not very many people on this podcast, listening to this podcast, will be surprised, but some of you might be surprised to find how much the software costs compared to the hardware.
Yeah, maybe that's a good point to end on, to say, go away and start questioning your own bill of materials first. Yeah. And then have a think about how this might affect you. I think this is an area to watch. I don't think we've got all the answers to this so far, but it's certainly an area where we're seeing a lot of change and a lot of things we need to keep an eye on going forward. So yeah. I think it'll be an area we will be revisiting.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, Martin, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you as usual, and catch up next time.
Yep. Cheers, Chris.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.